with your host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockeypedia Cast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me here is in studio is my good buddy Thomas Jantz. Tom, what's going on, man?
Not much, buddy. How are you?
Good. We didn't even really plan this. I just saw you around the office, and I'm like, get in here. Let's chat for a bit.
Well, once you told me it was about gambling, I was in.
Well, tangentially. the plan for today, the genesis of this was, I did a two-part with John Madison and Sean Shapiro yesterday. We did kind of our biggest takes from around the league, from the start of free agency, offseason movement so far. Within a two-hour show, it is a lot of time, but also you can only get through so much. So I felt like I left some meat on the bone. I wanted to kind of do a circle back and a little bit of a sweep with you, talk about some of the Pacific teams in particular, which is your area of expertise specifically. And so we talk about that and then kind of look ahead to 2025, right?
That specific division.
That specific division. I want to talk, I did some Kings and Oilers stuff. So I want to talk Canucks and Kraken specifically, okay. And then maybe compare the Pacific to the Central as well. Cause I feel like, I mean, the balance of power was already in the Pacific, right? We had the Vegas Golden Knights win the Cup 2 years ago. We had the Edmonton Oilers represent the West in the Stanley Cup final this year. So yep. It was already there, but it feels like now we're having a little bit of a shift where the Central is, I feel like, beefed up a little bit. The Pacific's, you know, at least from the Oilers' perspective, got stronger, I thought, this offseason, but it's becoming so concentrated where you're getting to the spot where I feel like the top three in the Pacific is so firmly established and they're just going to basically cannibalize all the points. And then I feel like all the other teams in the Pacific are going to struggle and fall back, including the Kings and the Kraken, despite all the money they spent.
I think I'm higher on the Kings and the Kraken in the short term than you are, but I think they've materially lowered their ceiling, and we'll get into that as we go.
Well, let's talk about the Kraken. Let's start with that.
Okay.
Because they spent a bunch of money, right? They, like, out of the gate, they came out hot. They gave out 2 7-year deals to 30-year-olds in Brandon Montour and Chandler Stephenson. I certainly prefer Montour as a player at this point. And he got a little bit more, I guess, about $750K or so per year. I see the logic in it, right? So sometimes when we sort of don't like moves teams make, we're like, I don't know what they were thinking. Where did they kind of come to this decision from? In this case, it makes sense, right? They were bottom of the pack in expected goals, high danger chances, actual goals scored last year. They clearly struggled offensively, and it seems like their entire agenda revolved around, let's bring in guys who can improve our offense. Now, Brandon Montour from the blue line makes a lot of sense. Chandler Stephenson's skating and the seasons he's had in Vegas, I get it. I just feel like considering the commitments they made and also the player in Stephenson's case specifically that they're getting here, it's really tough to justify for me.
I agree with you, especially on the Stephenson front. I think the thing I like about Montour in Seattle short term is when this team has played well, right? And the way that this team is built with Bjorkstrand and McCann and some of their wing talent, Burakovsky when he's in the lineup, even Eli Tolvanen, right? The sort of shot first or the one-shot scoring wingers thing, I think has been a really crucial element to their success. With Daniel Sprong still available, by the way, they should 100% pursue the reunion.
Bring the band back together?
I don't know why they wouldn't. He's like perfect for how they
there's
play.
There's 32 teams in the league where I'm like, I like the fit for Daniel Sprong. Especially at like 1 year for like $2 million or whatever.
And so does Daniel Sprong.
Yeah.
Anyway, the thing I like is if you have Dunn and Montour on different pairs, right? There's an element to which, you know, some of what Seattle has effectively done stylistically, and granted they've changed coaches, and I'm sure Dan Bylsma will introduce some different stuff as he, you know, gets his talons into how this team plays. You know, one of the things they did really effectively was that you work the puck down low and then you have that fourth man up high. So usually Dunn when the first pair's on, Justin Schultz did it a bit too, but they didn't really have like a consistent dynamic, like rover type to do it, would like join the attack and support the attack down low. And when they do, they'd have this one shot scorer, Tolvanen, Bjorkstrand, Burakovsky, McCann pivot up high. And then you get these awesome perimeter shots. So it's like a point shot, except it's a point shot being taken by a guy who's way better in terms of actually finishing than any defender you'll find.
Yep.
I like that they'll be able to potentially do that and play that sort of consistent style over 25 minutes each now, like or 50 combined minutes, as opposed to just having those Dunn Larson minutes and maybe occasionally Schultz would jump in, you know, in previous years. So I think it makes sense. I don't really understand the Stephenson fit. I really struggle with it. His speed has diminished. Maybe they're thinking that he can play some center for them. I guess they have some pretty good defensive wingers. I mean, you know, Eberle's a good two-way winger, and McCann is too, and Bjorkstrand is too, but none of them are Mark Stone, and we all know that. I don't know. Well, that one I struggle with more. The Montour fit, to me, at least fits within the normal bounds of, yeah, it's too much for too long, but you can see the vision.
You got better.
Yeah. Short term.
Yeah, Ron Francis, I believe after the signings, right, he had like that press conference, and he's like, this is a great day for Kraken hockey because it shows that players want to come here and play it. It's like, if you give anyone $40 to $50 million, and they'll certainly come to your team. I think we already probably knew that, especially in Stevenson's case, where I don't know. I mean, like, maybe
who else was
maybe
out?
You disagree with this because like the Canucks were linked to him, obviously not at this price. I think teams were probably interested because the center market was so shallow in free agency.
Yeah, the Canucks were in, but I never thought they were inner circle in. I thought they had some level of interest.
Yes. I mean, listen, like at his prime and a couple of years ago, I thought he was a very useful as underselling it. Like he was a good player. The issue is he showed so much decline last year, particularly in underlying stuff that drives all of his success, which is skating and transition work. He completely fell off the map as a puck carrier, as a guy entering the zone with possession. His passing metrics off those entries all fell off. And that's highly alarming for a guy who's 30, whose game revolves entirely around that, and who was in a perfect situation with Stone getting every puck off the wall to him in space. All of a sudden, you're removing essentially every single thing that made him so effective and asking him to be a $6.25 million guy for 7 more years into his mid-30s. That bet is just unfathomable, in my opinion.
I agree. It's too bad though, because he has been a $6.2 million player.
Yes.
Like, make no mistake, right? This deal is worth criticizing based on what it looks like going forward.
Mm.
But the idea, like, people will start to say stuff like, "Oh, he was never a $6 million player," but he's been one of the best values in hockey. Like,
yep,
he was a top 10 5-on-5 point producer in the league among NHL centermen over the last 3-4 years, right? Like, he's been excellent, sensational for Vegas. It's just, I don't like the bet going forward for them. Was there any injury? Is there any cause for optimism that it might have been a blip?
I mean, it might have been banged up. I don't know. I feel like everyone on that Golden Knights team last year was. At some point, it's tough to kind of decipher. I think there was also a bit of preparation in this, in the sense that, like, heading into this year, I agree with you that they're going to use that Dunn-Larson pairing. And the past couple of years, we've seen that maybe it'll change with a new coach. I doubt it, though. But like, they're going to lean on them heavily for a lot of the toughs, right? Like, they're going to like use that pair as kind of a matchup pair. And then they're essentially going to try to replicate the success Montour had in Florida, in the sense that they're going to play him with like a big, rangy, more defensively oriented partner in Alexiak, in this case, kind of like he was playing with Mikkola in Florida, on a second pair where he'll have a bit more cushion to explore offensively. And then it gives them right shot insulation because Adam Larson is a UFA next summer. And so I get it. He can kind of like step in, fill a role there. I get all that. The Stevenson one, similarly, Yanni Gourde is expiring after this season, right? And it's kind of a bit of a bridge for them where it's like...
And Yanni Gourde might have fallen off more than Chandler Stevenson last year. Like,
he did, but also environment-wise, it's tough. Like, I feel like...
His form was concerning.
Don't you think he's a player, though, that if he was competing for a Stanley Cup, there is more juice to squeeze there?
I hope so.
He might have just physically fallen off the map.
I hope so. I love the player.
Yeah.
But he is 32 and
plays a max effort guy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Plays a physically assertive style. Like, I'm just saying, I'm not sure. I'm sure that there's a lot of contenders that will have a lot of pro scouts watching this guy closely if the Kraken aren't in the playoff mix next season and wondering about whether or not he can be a key piece for them. Right. It would be malpractice not to investigate whether or not your theory that he can bounce back is true or not. But I look at him and think, I'm not sure. I don't know yet.
Yeah.
I want to watch a lot of Kraken next year before I make up my mind.
Well, it seems like it was an organizational need for them because they went out and, despite our questions about it, right, they spent all this money on these two guys that theoretically helped them offensively. They spend the 8th overall pick on Berkeley Cadden, who's like one of the most pure offensively minded prospects we had in this year's draft. So like, I like that from that perspective. They clearly, just as an organization, needed an infusion of high level skill.
Even at the fringes, right? Like, Ben Myers is a guy I like.
By the way, I love Josh Mahura.
Josh Mahura is a guy I like.
He can ball.
About to say.
He can ball.
He's sick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, so you know, good competition for Riker Evans at training camp. But I like the stuff at the fringes. I like how they draft. I like how they, you know, look to find value. But the big picture stuff I can't get over. Like dating back to the expansion draft when we were outraged that they didn't select Kevin Stenland, a take that we thought was like, we were like laughing about having a take like that, but yeah, actually kind of aged well.
I was genuinely upset.
I know. It didn't make sense.
I was like, Gavin Bayreuth, are you kidding me?
Their approach to the expansion draft of punting the power in a variety of instances to preserve money to chase goalies and over the hill players in free agency, like, was mind boggling. Made zero sense. And people will say stuff like, well, you know, GMs learned from the last time. It's like, you came in with unlimited cap space and you only needed to spend X amount to satisfy the conditions of expansion. And like, just because they learned over the course of a 48-hour roster freeze doesn't mean that the opportunities weren't massive to wait teams out. You know, like, I'll never understand their approach through to the expansion draft, and sort of everything that's come next to me feels like a team that, you mentioned Catton, eighth overall, and it's like they have to swing for upside like that, because this team looks to me to be one of those clubs that's locked into not good enough to make noise, not bad enough to get the type of player that might help them make noise, unless Matty Beniers levels up massively and Shane Wright has a big breakout season, which, you know, if both of those things hit, there's an upside case for the Kraken, but they really need both of those things to hit.
Well, and those offensive difference makers are the guys that are tough to find. I think it is encouraging from like an organizational health perspective that this Coachella Valley team made it to back-to-back Calder Cups, especially given how little time they've had relatively to build up a system, right? The fact that they already had that success is encouraging. Okay, here's the thing for you. So every year the team wins the cup, and then we all try to figure out what the lessons were from it and kind of what that means for the league and how the league's going to adapt it, right? I think with this Panthers team, much like other past cup champions, but I feel like especially so this year, they're such a Rorschach test candidate where you can look at them and you can kind of fit whatever narrative you want in terms of what drove their success and what we can learn from them, right? I thought the way teams acted as an overarching theme so far this offseason is interesting, because maybe we were already heading in that direction, but it feels like we really steered extremely so in the direction of teams valuing really fourth liners. I was going to say bottom six guys, but really it feels like fourth liners who can play fast and hit, mm-hmm, like play with pace and be like physical, functionally at least, and having no time really for
undersized
puck movers who aren't like legitimate stars that are already established, right? Like much preferring guys who box out and sort of these throwback defensemen. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I just feel like if you're kind of taking lessons from what teams did and the way they acted, that seems very clear, right? Because in a lot of instances, they were like either actively getting rid of those guys or showing no interest in them on the free agent market and giving out legitimate financial investments in term to these guys where people like you and I would probably look at it and be like, I can't believe that's what that guy got.
Yeah, I mean, the Kings, the Fogle Edmondson of it all felt like
I'm really
like
just describing the Kings free agency approach here with both of these.
No, but I think you're right. Like around the league, I think we saw a variety of moves, in terms of who was valued, who actually carried value. You know, another player type that didn't have a lot of value was, if you're not, I guess with the exception of Sean Monahan, if you don't have a ton of pace, if you don't have a ton of pace, it seemed like you better be a guy who's had 60 points, because otherwise you're going to be in trouble.
Teams are getting very tools oriented.
Yes.
Which is interesting to me, because I would argue the one team that has actively not been so are the Dallas Stars,
mm-hmm,
especially in their draft approach, right? You think about like a Wyatt Johnston, you go on Stankoven, down the line, Stankoven. Yeah. I mean, Stankoven at least can like pay with pace, but he's not necessarily like big or fast necessarily.
Exactly. That was the concern.
And so if they're to win a cup here soon, I wonder if we'll see a paradigm shift back into that direction, or if teams will just then talk themselves into like, well, like if they win the cup this year, it'll be like, well, they added Ilya Lyubushkin. So, I mean,
what's interesting is what we're seeing at the top end, you know, like you're talking about, if you're not one of those elite players,
yeah,
you better be able to box out. what's interesting is what we've seen across the board from the elite, elite players, from the Makar, Haskinen, Hughes milieu, and it's happened at literally almost the exact same time with Makar just being 1 year ahead, is the move to pair them with the sorts of defenders that seem to be undervalued in the marketplace. Now, granted, a lot of the players we're talking about, Sean Walker is not the player that Devon Taves is, or that Thomas Harley is, or or that Philip Peronic is, but he's closer to that class of player than Joel Edmondson, right?
Yep.
And so it's like, at the same time that we're learning this lesson about what enables the best defenseman to make maximum impact, we're also devaluing teams taking shots on that player type that might be able to cash in if you're lucky enough, blessed enough to land one of those true difference-making defenders, which I find confusing. I guess my question for you here, what I'd be curious to get your take on, is how much of this is connected to the swing away from possession hockey? Mm-hmm. To like the new, more direct, attack off the rush, save your shots to only shoot in the highest leverage, most efficient opportunities, effectively like the high shooting percentage era that we've sort of moved into, moving away from, whether you want to call it the fixed percentage era or the Corsi era. How much of this is an evolution of the game that actually is a reasonable response? You don't care as much about the undersized sort of defender that helps you outshoot your opponent. What you care about is how efficient those shots are.
I think that makes sense because I feel like we've almost bumped into a potential like limitation in terms of what you can do in open ice, because everyone is getting so good at skating now. Mm. And tactically, there's never been more emphasis placed on like preparation and game planning and like information being accessible to everyone, that there's just no more space on the ice anymore, right? Like I was talking to someone the other day and they're like, it's not like back in the day where you could just kind of like willy-nilly skate up the ice back and forth. It's like now, especially in the playoffs, when you just get rid of all the riffraff and it's just good teams who are like prepping for you on every single night, everything needs to be so deliberate in that sense, and there's no space. So it makes sense that you're not going to try to carry the puck as much anymore. You're doing what the Oilers really did and had success with against Florida, which was like setting up an anchor in the neutral zone, kind of dumping the puck out in terms of those aerials, and then trying to win battles in the neutral zone to then advance the puck, as opposed to actually going from point A to point B directly. Mm-hmm. And so it makes sense that you probably would need a certain level of physicality then to win a higher percentage of these battles, right? There's going to be players who aren't big or fast that are just smart and positionally sound that can kind of replicate a lot of that. But I see why teams are doing it. Even a team like the Devils, which is one of the more, I'd argue, like progressive, analytically minded organizations right now.
Clearly wanted to
They
wanted to get harder on the back end.
They brought in Dylan.
Yep.
They brought in Kovacevic. They brought in Pesci.
They got my guy Kovacevic.
They spent their 10th pick on a giant defenseman.
Yep.
Right? Then they bring in like Nason. They trade for Paul Cotter and get Alexander Holtz out instead.
I'm a big Paul Cotter guy, by the way. I thought that was one of the most misunderstood. You can tell people don't watch enough Devils hockey by the people who just like know that Holtz had draft pedigree. Mm. Reminded me a little bit of the excitement in the Vancouver market when Vancouver acquired a Vitali Kratsov, whose name's not really Vitali, but I just can never shake it as like what I think his name is. Cotter is more useful than Holtz. I don't know what else
he is, and he's cheap for a couple years. My quibble with it is purely on like what they did in the meantime on a significantly smaller scale, but similar to what the Jets have done with Nick Ehlers, where it's like you submarine a player's value internally to a point where then you wind up trading them for cents on a dollar and being like, well, that player is actually not worth that much. It's like you kind of created that market, though.
Mm.
Like I think there was certainly a scenario where if they had utilized them more responsibly and hadn't like actively talked poorly about him in the media along the way, they probably could have gotten more. I think that's fair. Like, I think that's a fair thing to say. I think there's certainly teams around the league that would have been like, well, this guy scored 25 goals, even if it was shooting percentage inflated or usage driven, that would have paid more. That's just the way it works.
It's also just important to like time it right. Like,
yes.
If you had concerns about him after he was lighting it up in Utica, it's like, that's the time to deal him.
Yes.
You know, like you would have gotten more then than they got now.
Now, with all that being said, we'll talk more about Vegas in a second here. I actually don't mind it from their perspective.
No,
because like logistically, we're going to talk about it. But
I just think people misunderstood the sort of value that he should
have. I think there was some sticker shock, right? Because it was like, all right, Akira Schmid's going to Vegas first, and it's like a third in Paul Cotter. And Holtz is going. I think like the way the information was relayed almost did them a disservice in that way. So a team that followed this trend and a team that has been very tools oriented for a while now, as you've been documenting, is the Vancouver Canucks.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess like a Danton Heinen might not necessarily be so. He kind of goes the other way where he's just a good hockey player, I think.
I was thinking about it and I was thinking about who to compare him to for someone who doesn't have a really good sense of Heinen. And I was thinking, I feel like he is like a poor man's Henrik.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like he's kind of like, he's got the versatility and like the main attribute there is that he can hang. You know what I mean? Like he can play he can play on that sort of in a second line role and he's not driving, but he doesn't hurt you.
Right.
You know what I mean? He can hold up. And that's hugely valuable. Like people, I think that's basically what Henrik does too. It's like he doesn't have there's not like huge tools or huge skill sets, but at the end of the day, if he's in your top nine, even when you get into like the hard time of year, the playoffs or whatever, you're not going to see him on the ice for a shift and be like,
yeah,
and like bracing the way you do with some guys who can't hang in those moments.
Yeah. But he's also one of those players that slips through the cracks year over year because there's no easily definable trait necessarily for you to latch on and be like, well, this is the justification for why we're going to value him on a 3-year deal. And so I know that he got that one deal once and then he wound up going, I think, from Pittsburgh to Anaheim, right? When they kind of cap dumped him, like he's bounced around a little bit. He keeps getting opportunities from teams, but they're always like, yeah, we'll take him. And then he winds up solidifying a role further up than they might have initially imagined because he's a good player.
Yeah, but then it doesn't translate into
the And then in the offseason, they're like, all right, well, we'll find someone who's faster or someone who's more physical or someone who's bigger or has a better shot. And it's like he does all that stuff.
Players are always not as good.
Exactly. And so I really like that bet from them. But otherwise, right, like they continue the trend of valuing really, especially tall defensemen.
Yeah.
Like Rick Tocchet really seems to have a type there. And he's gotten success, like, their defensive results last year were really good.
Yeah.
So I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
DeBrusque is a very toolsy player, right? In terms of like just the straight line north-south speed and the way he attacks offensively. So the Canucks were a team that sort of followed this trend. I think that's a good segue for us to talk about them a little bit.
I'd throw Sherwood in there too.
Sure.
I mean, slightly lower end, but you know, that's another guy who's got the speed and maybe plays with more consistent identity than a guy like Sam Lafferty, even though he's shorter.
Well, if this show had production value, right now we would do one of those, like, it would be like a sound effect, and then it would be like reminiscing about the time you and I were sitting on a couch in Palm Springs, just randomly talking about Kiefer Sherwood for 5 minutes during the Stanley Cup final breakdown for some reason, where you were like, I love this guy for the Oilers, for example, and then it would just be you talking about Kiefer Sherwood, and we spent an irrational amount of time talking about him.
Kiefer Sherwood's 100% another one of my guys.
Yeah.
He'll be on my guy list preview.
In September,
next year.
I like the DeBrusque fit because I think, especially if you're viewing it through the perspective of he's essentially taking Ilya Mikheyev's spot on this Jeb chart.
Except I think Heinen is. I would say Heinen's the Mikheyev replacement and DeBrusque is the Kuzmenko replacement who never was.
Right.
That's how I would think of it.
I guess just financially though, right? Because they paid such a modest price to get off the $4 million they owed Mikheyev, right? Like it was stunning to me that that's all it took.
Wild.
It was like a less than 2-round drop in a 2027 draft.
Yeah. I'd like to see them wriggle out of this one.
Yeah.
nevertheless.
And so they were able to do that. And then they used that $4 million essentially to be able to go out and spend what it took to bring in DeBrusque, right? Now, I think there's a misunderstanding of what he is as a player, because I initially saw a lot of, this is the Elias Pettersson teammate. I guess that's what you're referencing there, where like he won't be the guy who takes Mikheyev's spot next to Pettersson. He might initially, the daily faceoff depth chart for them suggests he will.
They're going to try it.
They're going to realize, and I say this lovingly, he's not the smartest player offensively, which is fine because he plays such a direct north-south game. But I think for Pettersson, he needs someone who's going to be able to think the game at a bit of a more nuanced level. And that's not really what DeBrusque does. Whereas with Miller, I think he'll thrive because they'll just go north.
Yeah.
And so I think he's going to be great there.
Predictability is everything.
Yes.
For complimenting JT Miller, Tanner Pearson once described it to me as stupid smart hockey.
Mm.
You play stupid smart hockey and you'll have success with Miller and Besser. That was his formulation. And you know, I'll always remember it because I love the phrase, obviously, but stupid smart hockey. I like Jake DeBrusk is made to excel playing stupid smart hockey.
Yeah. I guess my concern, though, is, and maybe if you feel like Heinen is going to fit this spot, I feel like they haven't addressed one of the biggest needs heading into this offseason, which was finding a running mate for Elias Pettersson.
Mm.
If DeBrusk is going to be that player that you just committed that money to.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a thought internally that they might see what Sherwood can do there.
Mm.
Hoglander, obviously, is a running mate that they've used there in the past. But yeah, I think that's fair comment. Like So I have a lot of reactions to this, all of them complicated.
Mm.
One is, I do think Hoglander, Pettersson is a duo that those players are comfortable with. The other is, I do think there's some school of thought that a guy like Sherwood, who plays on the edge and can maybe bring a little bit of that policing dynamic, might be a nice thing to have on Pettersson's wing. And then the final one is, for some reason, Joshua and Garland, who are Vancouver's best set of play-driving wingers, like together as a duo, and, you know, I'd mostly assign credit to Garland for doing the heavy lifting in terms of driving for that duo, but I also have seen Garland struggle to get the sort of deployment commensurate with his clear impact for years and years. And for whatever reason, you play him with Joshua and all of a sudden Rick Tocchet's like, you're my second line in the playoffs.
Mm.
So I don't think they could do it without one another. I do think there's a meaningful symbiosis between them. For whatever reason, they played 12 minutes with Pettersson last year.
Mm.
And it's just like,
yeah,
I really do want to see that. They worked so well with Bluger. They worked so well with Suter. They worked so well with Miller. And so why not take your best play driving centerman and a great one shot scorer and combine him with, you know, a guy who's just going to bang and crash at the net and has pretty good hands in tight in Dakota Joshua, and your best 5-on-5 playmaker, which is Connor Garland. I mean, like, what doesn't make sense about that? I really want to see that given a lengthy look next season. I want to see that given a lengthy look next season more than I want to see, like, DeBrusk shoehorned into that role, because I do think it'll work. I mean, Pettersson did have success with Lafferty. He did have success with DeBrusk. There's this school of or train of thought in Vancouver anyway. People will say stuff like, oh, why can't your $11.6 million center make players better? You're just ignoring that Sam Lafferty had like a career high 13 goals last year.
Right.
That Ilya Mikheyev, like generally until the last 60 games, looked competent offensively during his time in Vancouver.
Yeah.
Ignoring the 40 goal season that Andrei Kuzmenko had. Right. I mean, he's done a lot of elevating despite what, you know, the boomer set might have you think. Mm-hmm. And I do think it can work with DeBrusk, but I also do think if you designed the optimal left winger for the Miller-Besser duo in a lab, I feel like it would look an awful lot like Jake DeBrusk.
Yes. I guess one of my, what I find interesting about their approach is, and I'm sure I'd be curious to know like what the mindset heading in was and whether they just wound up going this way and kind of pivoting as it went along, was in the aggregate, I don't necessarily mind the Myers contract, the Forbort addition, the Vinny Desharnais addition. The issue is that in the aggregate, you put it all together and you wound up spending $6.5 million total on the cap next year, or I guess the next 2 years, or no, Forbort's only 1 year, but Desharnais 2 years.
Myers 3.
For next year, $6.5 million on three players that don't have very much puck moving ability and are going to leave you in a spot once again where you're going to be very reliant on your top pair.
You got to lump Carson Soucy in there too, because
I think he's a good player though.
Yeah, for sure he is. He's a really good player.
He provides utility like that's very easily definable in a different way and makes sense why they would like him. But if you're going to rely on that guy on your second pair, I just think you need more puck moving juice. And I would much rather, like, this happened with Dallas as well. And this is one of my quibbles with this approach. The volume tactic of like, we're just going to add three guys for $6.5 million. I would much rather you just spend $5 million on a really good player and then the league minimum on like two AHL defensemen that can play on the third pair. I just don't understand this approach of like bringing in a bunch of guys that don't actually help you that much.
Yeah. And so balance matters.
Mm.
Like, for example, up front, I think it's a different equation, right? If you're looking at Vancouver and assessing their chances next season, would you prefer that they'd added Steven Stamkos at eight or DeBrusk plus Sherwood plus Heinen? Right, like
the latter, for sure.
Having that balance matters up front, but I I wonder if it's perhaps overdone on the back end.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Where like at the end of the day, when you get into the heaviest minutes of the season and it matters the most, you're playing four guys for the most part, and then you've got a couple sort of specialists. Now, I was pretty shocked, I think, by just how much the Canucks doubled down on, you know, what we spent a lot of time last year talking about, which is this easily identifiable set of principles with which they play, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, they need speed on the wings, so they prioritize getting fast on the wings, right? Sherwood can move, can fly. Heinen's fast. DeBrusk's really fast. And, you know, part of the reason that they do this is they rely on wingers to set up this neutral zone wedge that sort of tries to take away the center of the ice, forcing entries along the wall. And then when you get there, there is a giant body standing in your yes. way, which makes it incredibly difficult to... Like, one thing I like about Vancouver going in on size is it's not just that their defensive scheme relies on playing in zone and making life difficult in terms of getting to the gritty areas of the ice or the meat of the ice. The way they play also leverages that size to make it very difficult to gain the zone against them. And so given how intelligently and thoughtfully Vancouver uses, you know, the thicket of trees on their back end, I understand why they're doubling down on it. But, and especially because it's done in concert with the speed on the wall thing. But I agree with you that, like, you might even including Quinn Hughes, who is a magician.
Mm-hmm.
Where would you rate Vancouver's top six defenders? And you throw in Noah Jules, top seven defenders, on a list of like most puck skills on the back end in the NHL, like bottom 10 for sure, right?
It's, I think, probably league worst for like teams that are trying to win.
Okay, yeah.
Right? Like, I don't know. I can't, off the top of my head, I'd have to do more homework on this, but I can't really think of a team that's like a playoff team that has aspirations of making it to a conference final, at least.
With less support.
That has less cumulative. Now, you could argue that just because Quinn Hughes is going to play so many minutes and handle such a lion's share of that responsibility, that it moves them up.
Except that his minutes went down in the playoffs.
Right.
So, you know, if they were going to Duncan Keith Hughes' minutes in the playoffs, it would feel different to me. But it feels like Vancouver wants to play their size even in the biggest moments. So I think my enthusiasm for that
gets tempered a little bit.
Now, that said, Forbert was viewed by the club as an affordable one-for-one replacement for Ian Cole, and I have no problem with that bet.
Perfectly reasonable.
I think Forbert's got some deceptive puck skills. I don't think he's as like good at that like hesitation first pass. Like, I think Ian Cole's actually a pretty underrated puck mover. I think he's got actual offensive intelligence, even if he's never going to be a point producer himself. I think Forbert is in a slightly different category on that end, but I still think Forbert's got some of that in his game. Nonetheless, Forbert was a one-for-one Ian Cole replacement done early in the day.
I mean, all he has to do is not score repeatedly on his own team, and he's already an upgrade.
Yeah, I mean, Cole was so cut up in like...
Yes, of course. Know,
there's crucial context
there.
He was great in the Nashville series,
yep.
and then he gets cut, and then... He wasn't the same guy, and it was costly. Anyway, fair point. I don't know why I'm so defensive of this guy.
It was just a throw-in joke.
You know? I know. I'm like, you don't have to. You.
Well, actually, me. No, let's go ship by ship, bud.
I think the DeHarnay thing came about later, right? Mm. And, you know, the Oilers deciding to move on from DeHarnay, signing Josh Brown with more term but for less cap money.
Well, they wanted... I saw someone make this joke. I think it was on the PDO guest Discord. I forget. Everything blend together on July 1st. But they just wanted the social experiment of having the best player in the world and the worst player in the world. His numbers are aggressively bad.
I know. But Josh Brown's a great guy. And that one I'll take personal offense to.
I didn't say the worst guy in the world.
How dare you besmirch Josh Brown?
Amongst NHLers. Not a big, like, rec league guys.
All good. What's the gap between him and DeHarnay?
Darren is pretty good. I mean, I think he was hurt, especially in the playoffs, and he just couldn't really move as much, mm-hmm. and that's why he lost his spot. I think he's never going to like be Cale Makar, but I thought he moved much better earlier in the year, and then towards like in the playoffs, he just looked kind of glacial.
Yeah.
And so that's why he lost his spot. I don't think that was a representation of what he is. I think he's a useful player.
Yeah, me too.
He took a step this past year from like the Vegas series 2 years ago where he just got played off the ice.
Yeah.
He wasn't that player in the regular season last year. I thought he was actually quite serviceable.
Yeah.
He was playing with the best third pair defenseman in the world, Brett Kulak. So
yeah.
Maybe that kind of clouds my judgment a little bit.
Brett Kulak will make a lot of partners some money.
He will.
Anyway, Harnay, I think, was a surprise to them that he was available. I think there was always an assumption that he'd return to Edmonton. And I think when he hit the market, I don't think the team was like necessarily, not like that they weren't ready for it, just that I don't think they thought that he would be a consideration the way he was. And late in the day, they were able to get that deal done. That deal was, a product of sort of the pro scouting staff and Adam Foote in particular, identifying him as like a project player that they thought they could get more out of. So he's paid and signed to be a third pair guy. But I think the organization sees a guy who's played like 100 games in the NHL and has a lot of tools and moves pretty well for a guy his size, and for sure is an exceptional penalty killer, and that maybe there's more that they can leverage with some coaching in addition to the way that they play the game.
Mm.
Now, all of this said, I don't think the Canucks would tell you confidently. Like, if you were to say, do you have enough puck moving outside your top pair? Key hockey operations leadership would say, well, we're not sure.
Mm.
Right? We're not sure. DeHarnay is a project that fits so well with what we want to be that we're going to give it a shot. And we're going to see what we have. And so the fact that they're approaching this thoughtfully and then going about building their team with at least a hint of skepticism, at least with an understanding that ultimately, hey, you know what? We'd eventually like to get to the point where we can bring in another, you know, 2-3 defenseman, right? Ideally, a right-handed 2-3 defenseman who could potentially play with Quinn Hughes so that we could have a Hronek-Soucy second pair so that we had more, you know, get up and go on the back end in aggregate. You know, I think that's like aspirational. That's where they'd like to go to. But they think DeHarnay is a unique player and a unique project and a guy who fits how they want to do things so well that I think they're going to give it a few months. Now, that's not to say that they don't add another defenseman at some point this summer. They still have about $3.5 million in cap flexibility. I think that'll be something they prioritize if the right opportunity presents itself, although they'd love to not use LTI at all this season, which they're currently set up to potentially do. But, you know, this is not like a finished product
right.
defensive group. And I think while the club has definitely built a back end that I'm not confident is going to be able to get up and go consistently enough to avoid getting bogged down offensively the way they did too frequently in the playoffs, I don't think it's a finished product. And I don't think they're viewing it as something that they're like, no, our particular brew will for sure work. You know, we know it.
Right.
I think it's more like we believe in the talent of this player and we believe in our structure and we're going to give it some time to see if we can make it work.
Well, on that note, Scuba Steve posted in the PDOcast Discord saying, I listened to the full 2-part review yesterday and there was no Bruins talk and I'm disappointed. We gave you some Derek Forbert breakdowns right here. So
yeah, there you,
can't, you can't say we didn't talk Bruins-related topics.
If you want me to go in on Zadorov and...
No, it's fine. We'll have plenty of time to do that. Let's. We way overshot our break here. So we're going to go to break right now. And then when we come back, we'll jump back in. We'll finish up by talking about some 2025 Stanley Cup odds and kind of frame it through that lens. You're listening to the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Here on the Hockey PDOcast with Thomas Drance. We're talking Pacific Division takes, but also now let's do some 2025 Stanley Cup odds. You've got them out in front of you here. Edmonton has jumped up to the very preliminary Cup favorite by a slight margin. They should
be favored by more.
Well, they were very close to winning this past year, and then they got better.
This is the best forward group since the late 90s Detroit Red Wings.
Well...
And the late 90s Detroit Red Wings didn't have Connor McDavid.
That Avs group that won the Cup 2 years ago was freakishly good. when they like while Burakovsky was healthy
and Compher, and
but then Burakovsky, Kadri, along with Landeskog, MacKinnon, and Rantanen, and that was
sick,
pretty nuts. Also, the Lightning team, they were at their best with like Gord and Coleman
and Gaudreau,
and then I guess Stamkos was kind of in and out at that point.
Yeah. Like he played
Killorn, Killorn, Kucherov point. I mean, that had a pretty, and Cicerelli, like.
But I mean, we're looking at an Oilers team that's going to have like two middle six guys on their fourth line.
Yeah. I'm very curious to see what they do.
We're talking like Brown, Janmark, and Henrique probably as a fourth line.
Well, that's probably the third line, right? I guess so. Well, they were using them as such in the playoff.
Yeah, run. But yeah. I honestly don't at this point. Probably won't
for the entirety of the regular season.
I don't think it is. Like, I think your third line's going to have, I mean, depending, it's either going to have McLeod, Holloway, and, you know, Skinner, or another clear top six caliber guy, or you're going to split Holloway and McLeod, and it's going to have two top six caliber guys.
Yeah.
Like, it's.
Yeah, I mean, if they're able to turn Kane's cap hit into a CC upgrade,
that'd be amazing.
Then obviously I think that's the final product here, and they have time to do so, because the point I keep making is I don't really care what these teams look like for like now. The cup contenders that I feel good about, I don't care what they look like on July 4th. I care what they look like in April.
Yep.
And so I'm
dead on.
Everyone's so preoccupied with like filling out their depth chart and using every single possible cap dollar to have a team right now, and it's like, doesn't really matter.
No.
I guess you can sell hype to your fans, but
yeah,
you have Connor McDavid on your team. It doesn't matter. I think they'll be hyped regardless.
They should be.
So obviously love what they did. So they're the cup favorite. Rattle off some of the sort of consolidated rankings here for us so we can go through them a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, look, let's do it in segments, because that way if we go team by team, you and me, we're going to...
This is going to be like an 8-hour show.
We're going to start at the bottom and talk about the Calgary Flames for 45 minutes. Like, let's not do that. So here, I'm going to call inner circle contenders are 15-1 odds or less.
Yeah.
Okay. And that includes Edmonton, Florida, Dallas, the New Jersey Devils, the Carolina Hurricanes, the Colorado Avalanche, the New York Rangers, and the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Okay.
Public team Toronto Maple Leafs. Come on.
Yes. Yeah.
They don't belong up there. There's at least a couple teams that I didn't mention who should have shorter odds to win the Stanley Cup, I think, at this point.
Right.
That said, if you have Auston Matthews, I think you do belong in the top half anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, what stands out to me there, to be totally honest with you, is how chalky that is, with the exception of the New Jersey Devils. Like, all of those teams, except the New Jersey Devils, made the playoffs. Most of them went deep into the playoffs, like at least one around, right? With sort of the exception of the Maple Leafs, who at least made it to Game 7 overtime.
Yep.
So really, I think one thing that I take away immediately from that inner circle contender tier is the market really likes what the New Jersey Devils did in general to add some heft and weight to their team.
I would argue that, I mean, obviously they needed to do something, but I would argue that very minimal moves still would have resulted in them being quite high. Just because I feel like everyone would have looked at their season and what they had done with the context of the previous year and been like, well, it was an unfortunate year. A bunch of guys got banged up. This wasn't a representation of what they are as a team. If they have a healthy version of Jack Hughes back and Dougie Hamilton as well, we're going to like them. So I feel like it would have already been trending in that direction. Maybe they wouldn't have been quite as high otherwise, but obviously we like the additions that they made, factoring in Markstrom as well, which feels like it was from a different offseason because it happened so far ago, so long ago. But yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I was telling you that I feel like the only reservation that I have on the Panthers really is that it's just really hard to string together back-to-back seasons in this NHL.
How about back-to-back-to-back trips to the finals?
True.
I mean,
yeah, you're right.
They've played
a lot of hockey,
an extra half season.
And like a very demanding style as well.
Now, the Tampa Bay Lightning did it.
Yeah.
Right. And, well, I mean, the Nate Schmidt ad is a nice one for them. I mean, relatively speaking, I think he's a pretty flawed player in terms of the turnovers and on and
on. Yeah, but in that system, I think it'll be fine.
Exactly. The Panthers are so good at just turning. And then I guess the only other reservation I'd have is I don't know what they look like in 12 months.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Or I don't know what they look like by September. We know how.
But don't we feel like that's exciting? Like, based on the track record of Bill Zito right now, I would argue that the fact that they have flexibility to go a couple different directions with trades
is a reason to buy their
upside. It's like, they could get even better.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe they're in for the reverse Tampa, where, like, you make three straight cup finals, but you win the latter two as opposed to losing the last one.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, the Panthers, to me, are maybe the most interesting story to monitor over the balance of the summer, just because I think there's a real trend in so much of Bill Zito's activity. We talked about it right after they won the cup on this very program, where the way that they've managed to pay guys for their 20s and duck paying the wrong ones for their 30s, unless it's Gustav Forsling and he takes a preposterously team-friendly haircut, I think is a model for everybody. Right. In this age of bridge deals, even the Anton Lundell deal recently. Right.
Yep.
I mean, Florida does not do bridges, period. It's very flat. In the land of the intercoastal,
they cross no bodies of water.
In the land of the intercoastal, there are no bridges for the Florida Panthers. And that's the way it should be, by the way. Mm-hmm. Like, more teams should be looking at the sort of contractual intelligence of how the Panthers have dealt with their own players, because I think it's a key driver of their success.
So were the Habs in that top tier that you cited off?
They were. They're 14-1,
right,
tied with the Carolina Hurricanes. And I think that's probably right. They feel pretty flawed at this point. They feel like they're going to need, that said, I've liked some of what they've done at the margins, Brännström in particular, getting, Drouin done again too, I thought was absolutely essential for them. But
and lumping in a middle stats extension as well, like getting him at a reasonable number.
But they're going to have to move at least another guy, right?
Well, they're in a bit of a holding pattern right now, and the reason why they were operating so much on the margins was they essentially have, what, 13 plus million in like uncertainty with Nichushkin and Landeskog, and like not knowing whether that's money they can use right now for this season or whether it's something they're going to have to account for now.
Day,
I believe especially with the Nichushkin situation, like they're accruing cap space along the way, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be something they can utilize regardless. I don't know. I assume either, like, I wish this wasn't the case because I love the guy and he was such a great player. Anything you get from Landeskog at this point is foul money, in my opinion, because a guy in his 30s who hasn't played in over two calendar years, like the precedence of like that guy coming back and being anything resembling his previous self seems so far-fetched to me. I'd love to be wrong there. I think either Nichushkin comes back and is an impact player, or he doesn't come back and you have a rather significant amount of cap space to improve. So I feel like this Avs team, like looking at their depth chart right now, isn't a reflection of what that team is going to look like when games actually matter. They have enough talent to get through the regular season regardless.
I loved their approach at the draft too, where, you know, they don't care at all. Right, like they don't care at all. They did nail their pick in 2023. What's that gentleman's name? The big OHL center,
Cal Ritchie.
People love that guy.
Yep.
But I loved trading down, getting a 2025 second that you know is going to just be a trade chip for them. Like there's no very remote possibility that they'll ever use that pick, and then selecting the 21-year-old goaltender who won the Gagarin Cup as like literally the only guy in the draft other than maybe Macklin Celebrini and maybe Demidov, who has, well, Demidov's not even coming over, so just Macklin.
What about Zee Bouyum? What about Bouyum?
You think Bouyum can play in the NHL next year?
I mean, there's not much for him to do at the college level anymore.
Put it this way, there's not a long list of guys who could be an NHL impact player. Yes.
Especially in this draft at that part. Yeah, of course.
Well, there's no one at that point.
Yeah.
But I thought to manage the draft that way was extremely thoughtful, I thought, for a team in their shoes.
Yeah, for a thoughtful organization. I'm not surprised by that. I like what they did there. Okay, so any quick hitting Hurricanes thoughts? Because they also are in that tier, and they...
Well, don't you feel... So the lesson of sabermetrics, the original lesson of like applying data to sports analysis, right? Wasn't to, at least in baseball, it wasn't to build like the sickest possible OPS team, right? Like it was to think about things differently, right? And when I think about the Hurricanes and their moves over the course of this offseason, you know, obviously I'm sure the Gensel thing stings.
Yep.
Like that would have been a huge ad for them. He was at a 100-point pace after the trade. But where you talked about the emphasis on box outs and size on the back end. The Hurricanes were just like, okay, that's fine. This is where the market's going. We're going to sign Sean Walker for $3.6 million to replace.
And Gauss is better for $3.2.
Right. Yep. So they were like happy to be the team that zigged when everyone zagged.
Yes.
And that's like the real, at the end of the day, that's more than anything what it's about, right? Like that's what progressive thinking in sports kind of entails, is like finding value where the market is not. And I just thought the Hurricanes kind of did that to a T. You know, replacing Gensel with Jack Roslovic, that makes me a little nervous.
Yeah.
But
they have so much flexibility in the way of like prospects and desirable stuff to rebuilding teams that they can swing another Gensel like trade at the deadline.
It's a $61 million gap.
They're going to add a top line player value at some point.
100%. Now they're going to add two.
They might even with a Natchez trade potentially, right? Because they need to pay both. They're going to pay Jarvis, obviously. And then I think
they're going to keep Natchez.
You think so?
I do. Like, I mean, that's what I would do in their shoes, unless something presents itself that's can't miss.
Yeah.
You know, like unless there's a can't miss deal. But I mean, if you sign Natchez at
What about an Ehlers swap?
Yeah. I mean, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
But if you... Yeah, that would be incredible. But I just feel like they're either going to get value or they're not going to do it.
Yeah.
You know, and from what, like, you're not going to see a Natchez for spare parts type deal.
Yeah.
They're going to have a huge price in mind. So I'm really curious to see exactly how they go about filling out this roster. But yeah, they're not a finished product by any means. And I think I really liked the way they thought about and approached what I'm sure was a challenging offseason, given the fact that they couldn't get Gensel done despite sort of meeting his ask.
Any other notes on the teams in this tier? Do you want to go to the next one?
Let's go to the next tier. So this next tier is teams from 16-1, and let's go it through 26-1.
Okay.
And this will give us a nice little bumper crop that includes the Vegas Golden Knights at 17-1, the Boston Bruins at 19-1, the Predators also at 19-1, big lift after they added, you know, a bunch of finishing talent, Marchessault,
Stamkos. Well, when you spend a bunch of money in free agency, especially on big name guys, like the market will react that way, right?
For sure. The Canucks 21-1, the LA Kings 23-1, the Winnipeg Jets 23-1, and the Tampa Bay Lightning 26-1. Now, what's interesting to me about this is Boston, Nashville, and Vancouver were, when these lines opened, tied together.
Mm.
And with the Winnipeg Jets. So those four teams were tied together. And it's like the tier of Vegas isn't going to give you longer odds when you have Swayman, Demko, Hellebuck, and Saros in net. Vegas is just like, one of those goalies is going to cost us too much money, so we're not,
right,
we're not valuing any of these teams at better than 20-1. And so what I think's interesting about this is the separation, right? Where Nashville, my guess is the market reads it as Nashville had a bunch of worker bees and a structurally sound team that, you know, punched above their weight, but they couldn't finish, and that showed in the playoffs, and now they've added the best one-shot scorer of the last 20 years and Jonathan Marchessault. And now we
thought you're gonna make a joke. The best one-shot scorer and Steven Stamkos, because Marchessault scored so many goals last year.
Yeah, but no, I mean that would have been a good joke. Yeah. But Stamkos is the efficiency guy, right?
Course.
And then Boston, I guess, added the two big names in Lindholm and Zadorov. But I don't know that I'd say Vancouver performed worse in free agency than either of those two teams. And I don't know that Winnipeg did either. I mean, Winnipeg doesn't exactly do free agency. But, you know, my point being, I think the separation that the markets are seeing between those four teams is probably ephemeral and not substantive.
I thought Vegas was the most interesting team you mentioned there, just because I feel like there has been an overcorrection to them losing a bunch of free agents and them losing in round one to Dallas, right? Mm-hmm. In like a very competitive 7-game series against an awesome Dallas Stars team.
Right.
My argument for it is, at very vital positions, they have, for my money, the best center group in the league.
Yep. No question.
They have one of the best defense corps in the league, top to bottom, right? Like, even on the third pair, if it's Nick Hague and Zach Whitecloud, I can work with that.
I think Zach Whitecloud's hugely underrated. Also, they're going to make a move off of that defense core, right?
I think so. We'll get to that in a second. But you put those two together, and I get, like, this is baking in the risk that, like, Mark Stone, it's probably a matter of when and not if he gets hurt. And when that does, they can't really, as we saw last year, replace that functionally. Like, he's such an integral part of the operation that that cap space is not equivalent to his contributions to the team, despite people thinking that this is all part of some sort of master plan. I just like the idea that they're going to have a full offseason of getting healthy, getting rested, and then integrating Hurdle and Hanifin. Hanifin, like, was more sort of a smooth transition into the team. Hurdle was hurt when they acquired him.
Yeah.
And then he was playing on the wing, and he clearly looked rusty in the playoffs. I think he's going to hopefully look better and more like Tomas Hurdle at the start of the season.
Yeah.
And so you tell me all of that with a team that's clearly going to make some sort of a big move at some point. Like, the fact that they're lurking right now is like, should be frightening. Like, Jonathan Marshall coming out and calling them out for not giving him a competitive offer, and then them just being like, I guess McCrimmon did say, like, oh, that's not true or whatever. It couldn't be more false. But, like, they're just, like, right now sitting in some dark, dingy room being like, all right, we're going to get our revenge soon. They're going to do something. I like the gambit of whatever your mileage on Holtz and Olofsson, clearly flawed players. But I'd lump Brassad in there as well. Dorofeyev showed some shooting talent last year. This defensive environment and puck possession style with guys who can just take shots and turn them into goals, that makes sense, especially for like $1 million, which is what they're paying all those guys. So.
Even not factoring in Mark Stone, you know, like, they're going to be able to do something like Hurdle, Eichel, Barbashev on the top line.
Yeah.
And then Carlson centering a second line, you know, assuming that Stone is not even an option, like Carlson centering Dorofeyev and whomever, with like Nick Waugh on the third line center, and then Brett Howden at fourth line center. And it's like, that's good. That's a really good basis to be able to plug in some value wingers here. Another team that would be a perfect fit for Daniel Sprong.
Yes. Yeah. Them and everyone else.
I want to just point out the Kings at 23-1 in this tier.
I'm out.
I don't think they belong.
Yeah. Let me hit the eject button.
Yeah, that's mispriced.
I mean, I'd argue no team had a worse offseason. I talked about this on the last show. I don't necessarily need to get into it right now. I just hate their like organizational, philosophical shift here of like trying to become tougher to play against when you just got outclassed from a talent perspective the past couple years.
Yeah.
It just reflects a misunderstanding of what's happening and why your team is falling short. And
at this point, their only way out of the mess of the last 12 months, because I thought they'd done a lot of smart stuff until the PLD trade went sideways on them, and I even think it was smart to hit the eject button the way they did on it, even though you take the L, but to then continue taking L's with Fogle and the Edmondson deal, that starting to become a bit far for me to keep defending what I used to hold up as a model rebuild. But their only way out of this is Byfield and Brant Clark have to be so special now. And while I'm not like going to bet on it, and I think they're mispriced at 23-1, there's a chance.
I would have felt more confident if they had actually made a coaching change and you could be like, all right, well, this coach might actually open things up and try different stuff. Like, it feels like they're trying to run it back and double down on something that is already holding them back and be limiting them. So
let's go fringy tier, or are we running out of time?
I mean, we all ran way past time, but that's fine. It's one of the final shows this season. We're going to go a little long. It's a little marathon.
The next tier, let's call it the like wild card tier, the pretenders tier.
Yeah.
This is 36-1 through 50-1.
Okay.
And it includes the Ottawa Senators at 36-1.
Nice.
The Detroit Red Wings at 41-1.
Okay.
The Minnesota Wild also at 41-1. The New York Islanders at 46-1. And the Pittsburgh Penguins at 46-1.
Nice.
I think I like the Ottawa Senators the best of that group.
Yeah.
They have the shortest odds, but they should have the shortest odds. They added my guy, Michael Amadio.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand the Chikrin deal. And you think Jensen's cooked, even though he's one of my favorite defensemen in the last 5 years.
He didn't look very good last year. I get the logic where he has an extra year. The handedness is important because they're so lefty-oriented right now. And I felt like they were at an impasse. Like, they just needed... It makes sense. The past couple of years, the way things have gone in Ottawa, like, they're valuing like people who are just going to be like...
Pros,
who like aren't going to be releasing quotes and like liking tweets and but like not the Chikrin was, but I'm just like drama constantly surrounding this organization.
Totally.
I think they want to get away from that, like Allmark and Jensen, like just reliable guys that you're
and gonna... David Perron.
Yeah,
and so I actually think David Perron and Brady Tkachuk could be fun because just in terms of like playing area game down low, but beneath the hash marks, you know, Perron has been like, his skating speed has been off for a long time. Like, I remember David Perron's breakout season really, really clearly in 2008.
Mm.
That was a long time ago, man. Like, I had hair. Like, it's unbelievable. And like, I remember him as this like pretty fast winger who was super hard on the puck, you know, on that like Bacchus Oshie Blues team, right? And like when they sort of just pulled out of that rebuild. And like, I don't think he's been fast for 5 years. It hasn't mattered.
There's gonna be guys in the NHL soon who weren't even born back then.
It's wild. Like, yeah. I literally like have this clear, that team got so hot in the back half of the season, and I can remember watching Perron and just being like, this guy's so hard to knock off the puck.
Yeah.
But he was like fast.
Right.
That was a million years ago.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Anyway, with the way Perron plays though, I feel like he's been able to extend his career, especially when he's able to play with like smart, physically imposing centerman, like what he did with Ryan O'Reilly, where if you're able to play that like area game beneath the hash marks with him,
mm-hmm.
I think he's like a deviously effective creator off of the cycle. And there aren't a lot of centermen around the league who I'd like hit my knee and be like, that's the guy. But when I saw him sign in Ottawa, I did think, oh my God, him and Brady Tkachuk, that makes sense to me.
I'm interested. I hope their PK is good.
Yeah, fair enough.
A lot of penalties.
Well, that we didn't bring that up in relation to Vancouver's Forest on the back end.
That's true.
There's their penalty kill better be damn good,
too. Mm-hmm. I don't have any other notes on that group. You may as well light money on fire at this point.
Islanders?
I mean, I liked Duclair edition was nice.
And yeah, exactly.
I'm fine with it. I mean, we're talking about winning a Stanley Cup here.
They have another move to make, too.
Mm.
Okay. The next tier, let's call this...
I think this tier is interesting.
Me too. Well, this is the one to spend money on. This is like, save your bets for this tier, baby. Let's go 50 to... let's go 50 to 61.
Okay.
Buffalo Sabres, 51 to 1.
I'm ready to get hurt again.
Me too. Seattle Kraken, 56 to 1.
I mean...
They're going to bounce back. They're
I
not
think I like them more than a
season.
Lot of the teams you mentioned in the previous year.
100%, me too.
Especially with the Pacific Division, right? Like, I think they could...
They should be priced with Ottawa. At the very least, it's a misprice,
In
my opinion. Like, what's the gap between Ottawa and the Seattle Kraken? Seattle's got, like, better, younger talent.
But I feel like Seattle has a much more realistic path to also, like, squeezing into the playoffs. And at that point, it's like, all right, well, at least you have a chance.
Yeah, exactly. I don't even think they have a realistic shot of squeezing into the playoffs. I think they could have just a bounce-back season.
Like,
there's a real chance that Matty Beniers... is just like, oh, right, he's like a 65-point play-driving two-way guy.
Yes.
Because he's sick.
Yeah.
And he had such a bad year last year, but I don't think that's who he is.
No.
So, if you think there's a chance that Matty Beniers gets back to playing like, you know, this monster that he was as a rookie, and I think it's a very high likelihood. That's the
Kraken fans listening right now are like, experiencing the full range of roller coaster emotions where we spent the first 10 minutes critiquing them and now we're spending the final 10 minutes talking about them winning the Stanley Cup.
Well, so, look, I
both things can be true. We're allowed to have multiple thoughts in our brain at once.
Right. Thank you. St. Louis Blues 56 to 1. I think I'm out on that.
Yeah, there's a listener in the PDOcast Discord as well that is like, anytime you ever mention the Blues, it's in passing just to reinforce that they're mid.
Yeah.
And I'm going to continue doing so.
Fair. Now here's one that I like. The Utah Hockey Club at 56-1.
Oh, baby, let's go.
Sign me up.
I wish they would have been a good Allmark team. Because if you told me they just had him and Ingram for 82 games, similar to Swayman Allmark, that would give them such a high baseline with that forward talent
instead
and now the defenseman.
Vejmelka.
Which is fine. Like, I think he'll be okay.
Yeah, Vejmelka's good.
Yeah. I just would have liked 40 games of Allmark instead, especially for the price that Ottawa paid.
Connor Ingram, though. I think he's a player.
He's awesome.
And now, you're not a big Sergachev guy.
I just think he's been overrated.
Yeah.
But clearly an upgrade for them.
Huge
I mean, it goes without saying, considering they literally had no defenseman signed to NHL deals before the draft.
Do I finally get my dream of watching what would happen if Sergachev is used as a 1A, or is it still going to be Durzi on the power play?
No, I think it'll be Sergachev.
Let's go.
I guess I was going to say he got paid, but
we'll
Durzi
think,
does as
well.
We'll
think of a way. So I don't even know if we've ever had the argument on air, But
the Sergachev debates, the Sergachev wars of 2022 or something.
So we've had a lengthy running disagreement on Sergachev's quality as a player. And this year we get to find out, because one of my big arguments to you has always been like, if he had a chance to be a 1A guy, he'd be like a 60 point. Blah, blah. So we'll find a way to monetize it next season.
Undoubtedly a talented guy. I don't want people to misconstrue that. I just feel like when other teams are playing against you and their game plan revolves around attacking your weaknesses, I'm skeptical of you as being like a linchpin guy of a blue line core.
Fair enough. I think
he's like a nice player. Now, I like the Marino ad.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Jersey fan, for entertainment purposes at least.
Yeah.
add Valimaki in there. Like, this is going to be a good group. Like, I think they're going to be fun. I'm very excited.
Dylan Gunther is also like a monster.
Yeah. Having a unbelievable one. Having a Utah Hockey Club long shot ticket. I mean, that sounds amazing.
That sounds fun, right? Yeah. No, 56-1. Them and Buffalo are probably my favorite bets on the board. I wish
Buffalo did more, but they're a team that is still TBD because they have so much room and clearly are actively pursuing the trade market. But like, they need Nikolaj Ehlers, or like they need
Buffalo
a bit more juice. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
Because all of their moves are like fourth line guys.
For sure.
And they have the young players atop the lineup, but I think they need a bit more.
Yeah, I agree. Philadelphia, 61-1. And the Washington Capitals, 61-1.
See, I'm surprised the market didn't swing more in their favor, similar to what we said about Nashville, because they made so many trendy moves.
See, I actually think they made good moves.
No, they did.
Yeah, I'm in. I think I'm in on, like, I can make the case for Philadelphia on the possibility that Mitchkov's just...
Well, they were almost a playoff team. They should have been a playoff team last year.
And now they're adding a guy who just like absolutely
who's going to address their biggest weakness.
Yeah. Well, he could legitimately be like there's obviously a gap, but there's a chance that they're adding a, you know, just sub Connor Bedard quality 19-year-old to their lineup. Like he could be a 75-point, 80-point guy year one. Absolutely. No question about it. So if he is, Torts lets him be. What do they have there? I'll be fascinated to see. So I at least I can see the case for Philly too, but I'm kind of out. I'm out on the fact that they're going to have a great 7 weeks and then Torts is going to wear everyone else out both physically and mentally. And then they're going to struggle down the stretch just like every year. Like, why do we keep pretending that this isn't the most predictable thing in hockey? Anyway,
escalated so quickly.
Well, it's just so annoying.
You talk yourself into a tizzy.
I'm just like, I could make the upside case for them if they had a real coach.
No, George is a good coach. Come on.
He is a great coach.
Yeah.
At getting teams right to the precipice of you believing in them and then having them completely fade. But maybe they don't fade so completely that they might sneak into the playoffs and pull a tremendous round one upset. But that's all they're ever going to do.
I mean, last year was like a success, though. I mean, think about the talent they had and what they got in that group, right? Like,
Torts with a limited group?
Yeah.
You're cooking with oil, humming. Baby.
Yeah.
You're cooking with oil until the calendar turns to March every time out. Yeah. Anyway, the Washington Capitals, 61-1.
Yep.
I actually like that.
I do too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fine. I mean, it's a 61-1. Like, I was going to say they're not going to stand the cup. I think that goes without saying, but they have a good team.
Yeah.
They added a lot of good guys. And what I liked about it is, unlike in a lot of cases, it's like, all right, they got better, but at what cost? In this case, if things do go south, they will be able to add retained salary, particularly with Mangiapane, Chychrun,
With maybe Logan Thompson, Dubois.
They can pretty much just get back, I think, even more than what they paid for those guys, right? Like, they're going to get back legitimate draft capital.
Mangiapane might have been the steal of the of the offseason, to be totally honest with you. I think that deal is going to be a home run. I'd add this, like... I hurt my ankle down in Palm Springs and
the listeners know.
Yeah. And after you left, I was sitting there cause I had no one to hang out with anymore. And all the Calder.
don't make everyone feel depressed now.
No, I'm just saying.
I was sitting in a dark room by myself after my one friend on earth left.
Once the house was empty and my wife came, so I had no one else to hang out with anymore. No, I'm kidding. My wife was the best. No, but I was watching those games cause they're on like cable in the desert. And, I want a lot more Miroshenko stock than I've had before. I want all of it. In fact, I thought one thing about him. I thought he was like kind of like a brainless shoot from anywhere guy with a little bit of pest in him, but he's become a lot more than that. I'm in.
I mean, it's such a traumatic event at such a key developmental time. Like, I'm willing to give him wiggle room. And where he's at already at this point, considering where he was a couple years ago, I think it's...
I'm in.
Yeah.
I think he's going to be awesome next year.
Yeah.
Like, I want...
I like what I saw with McMichael, LaPierre. Like, they got these guys meaningful reps. I know that sometimes can be, like, overstated of,
LaPierre
like...
LaPierre was a monster team in the Calder Cup final.
Yeah. Like, so that's good. Important.
Yep. No, I'm in. I'm just in. I'm in on the Caps, generally.
They just have such an eclectic group of players.
I know. I'm in on Carberry. I'm in on them making the playoffs with a minus 45 goal differential. Like, I'm in.
Yeah.
I want cap stock in general. Okay. Here's the lottery ticket tier. 75-1 and lower. The Calgary Flames are 75-1 or 76-1, and they should be lower than that. The Montreal Canadiens are 101-1. The Chicago Blackhawks are 151-1. The Ducks are 201-1, which is unbelievable. The Columbus Blue Jackets also 201-1, and the San Jose Sharks 251-1.
Wow.
Yeah, Sharks are dead in the water.
That's where you draw the line.
I'm telling you, no. I think all of those teams are dead in the water.
Yeah.
But
I like the Flames more for first overall pick.
Me too. That's the way to play the Flames, is to bet on them being as bad as the teams lower than them.
Because think about it. They've already telegraphed. I know what they keep saying. I'm just not buying it. Like, I think in season, if the right deal comes up for certainly Rasmus Anderson, yeah. But even if like someone wants to take on the remainder of Blake Coleman, Kadri, like all these guys will become available. And they should be, quite frankly. I don't understand really the reluctance against it. So
should they not be calling the Montreal Canadiens and trying to get off of Huberto for like both Gallagher and Anderson?
Yeah, you've pitched this on the show before. It's certainly interesting.
Like, why would they not do that?
Yeah.
They should at least try.
Yeah. Like, maybe they have.
Yeah, they should be. Anyway, the...
Craig Conroy's too busy loading up on 8 defensemen.
There's all these tweets. Like, one thing about cheering for a rebuilding team is there's never evidence that the plan's not working, because the plan, the plan is projecting like years into the future. So fans of rebuilding teams do what I call the lists of mid, where it's like, look at what Craig Conroy got for the Elias Lindholm trade, right? And it's like, now that they've made all the picks, it's like 8 names. And it's like, look, I thought the Flames did well drafting upside guys in the draft, but by far the piece that the Flames acquired for Elias Lindholm most likely to ever make an NHL impact, by far, probabilistically speaking, is Andre Kuzmenko by a mile. Like, what are we doing here? Anyway, I like the Anaheim Ducks at 201-1.
Yeah.
I want shares of the Ducks. I always want shares.
We never learn our lesson. I feel like you could just replay the past like 3 years where we're like, Sabres and Ducks, baby. Let's go.
But you know what?
One year we'll be right. Like we were with the Devils 2 years ago.
And then we're wrong again.
Well.
But also I did this with the Hurricanes.
Yeah.
I know you regret that now. But
I'm back in.
But I do think the gap between a successful team and an unsuccessful team is bigger than we think. And I think it takes a long time to close that gap. But I also think once you accumulate that like critical mass of talent, it happens all at once. And it's just like, I don't know if this is the year that it happens for the Ducks, but I think they're getting close. Mm. So at this point for the next few years, I'm going to keep picking them. Just like I'm going to keep picking the Buffalo Sabres, just like I'm going to keep picking a New Jersey Devils bounce back.
All right, we got to get out of here. This really escalated so quickly. Like we pretty much did
we did two podcasts,
two shows in one after we had not planned to do a single one. But you know what? I don't regret it. This was fun. I'm sure the listeners are going to enjoy it. I think people are pretty pretty like interested in more content right now. Right. So I think people will be listening as we get into the off season here. Tom, plug some stuff. What do you want to let the listeners on the way out?
I'm about to take my summer vacation, so don't go looking for Canucks Talk, but it's usually available
Monday through Friday. Thomas Strands on Twitter.
Yeah, follow Thomas Strands on Twitter and subscribe to my OnlyFans.
For the three people still listening, they love that.
And follow my work at theathletic.com.
That was a great plug, bud. My plugs are go on the PDOcast Discord. Invite link is in the show notes. Smash that 5-star button. Show us some love for all the hard work we did this season. And if you're listening to this somehow and the show hasn't come out yet, we have one more show coming out yet with Brendan Dillon.
Ooh.
And we already recorded that one, so that'll be out, and that'll be our season finale.
Two podcasts with a guy wearing the exact same shirt.
Okay, yeah. So let's tell that joke on the way out. So I'm sitting in the bullpen here. We just recorded the show. We're kind of talking shop. Tom walks in for his shift to do his show, comments on the fact that someone sitting in the room is wearing the same shirt, and then looks up and sees that it's Brendan Dillon and starts laughing hysterically.
But it's not just the same shirt. It's
and then like, Brendan Dillon introduces himself and Tom goes, I know who you are.
Did I do that?
Yeah. It was great.
Awesome. I, the fact is, though, is it's not like a blue golf shirt. You know what I mean? Like it right. is, it is the same it's brand, Henley. The exact same shirt.
Yeah.
It was just really funny.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, this is great. Thank you to everyone for listening to us and for supporting the show. And usually I sign off by saying we'll be back with more of the Hockeypedia guests on the Sportsnet Radio Network. We won't because we're going off away for the offseason for our summer break. But thank you for listening. And yeah, the best way to keep up with the show is to be in that Discord because we'll be giving you updates on when the show's back and what to look forward to. So thank you to everyone for listening to us.